Welcome to the Amazon Legends Podcast, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became powerful sellers, also experts specializing in helping sellers, and both former and current Amazon employees who will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here's your host, Nick Urison.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today is a lifelong entrepreneur. By that, I mean since his childhood. So he started building businesses when he was little. So he's been going ever since. And he's currently the founder of Kicksmiths. And he's an avid golfer and heavily into cooking and movies. So hopefully not both at the same time. So with that, everybody, meet my guest, Kip Rowland. Welcome to the show,
Kip. Hey, Nick. Yeah, good to be here. Appreciate you having me on.
Oh, thank you. You are a very interesting guest. So, you know, I have to really take my hat off to you because not many people would do what you volunteered to do. So we emailed back and forth, and then you said, yeah, I want to do it. So it's very gutsy. So tell us, why are you here today?
Nick, I'm here to turn state's evidence, man.
Okay, well, you know, the thing that I find hard to believe is you're here to give some dangerous testimony. As yet, you know, there are no, like, blurring your face. There are no dark rooms or nothing. And you don't mind. You come right out and give it to us, right?
Yeah, maybe I haven't committed an official crime, but some people might think so.
So tell us what it is that really, I mean, joking aside, but it's true. I mean, I say that in all fairness, there are two business models on Amazon. And usually anybody we have is looking to build a brand. You don't belong in that camp, right?
Right. Yeah. I sell online arbitrage.
So you are the bad guy who goes out, buys merchandise, and then sells under existing ASINs that nobody wants.
Yes. So, exactly.
So tell us, first of all, tell us some of the key things that, so clearly you've been doing this long enough.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, of course, we talk about it in a bad way because most private label sellers don't like it. They don't like somebody else selling their product, which is not really what you're doing anyway. So you're doing, so I always say this, you know, if online arbitrage was to be frowned upon, then there would be no room for, you know, Sears, you know, Bloomingdale's or any department store everybody knows, there would be no room for them. So this is clearly a legitimate business, except that you have to adhere to certain rules. And also, frankly, you're doing it to make money and it gets harder and harder. So that's what we're going to talk about. So I want to congratulate you for coming out and share all the secrets openly. At the same time, you know, I want to learn, you know, some of the things that, because it's much easier to start that kind of an operation. You can be making money right from the get-go. You don't have to build a brand, spend money on advertising or anything, but you really have to be set up for it. So there may be other people who may want to do that so they can learn from your wisdom and your experience. So tell us about, tell us what you can tell us about online arbitrage so that you don't step on anybody's toes, you do it legitimately, and then you make money.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned that I've been doing it long enough. I've been doing it for about, seriously, I've been selling on Amazon for about a year and a half. So I'm still pretty new to it, but it's been long enough that I understand it's just been scaling and scaling and scaling. And like you mentioned, a lot of people don't like it. And that totally makes sense. I think there's a lot of people who sell online arbitrage in bad faith. They take fake products and they go under private label listings and they get bad reviews because they're selling fake products or they're tanking your price. And those people those people screwed up for everybody. You know, those aren't people who are doing it in good faith or trying to operate a business that will operate long term. I think that's something that I've learned throughout this whole thing is make decisions for the long term. You don't, you know, when you start making short-term decisions, things that will get you money quick, you start cutting some corners, and especially on Amazon, when there's so many strong, you know, there's a lot of legalistic things. You have to follow so many rules. If you start cutting those corners, your Amazon career is not going to last. And so, yeah, online arbitrage, that's what I've been doing. Basically, for those of you that don't know, at least from my perspective, I will search the websites. I'll search, you know, I have a niche that I go under. I usually, it's, I focus a lot on sports supplements. So that's vitamins or protein powder, pre-workout. And so I'll find websites or shop on, shop in store, and you're finding discounts, you're finding, closeouts, you're purchasing a lot of units, and then you're sending them to Amazon, under those ASINs. And so there's a ton that goes into it. And if we want to get into that, I'd be happy to. But yeah, that's just kind of just a brief thing about me, and as well as
let's start from the beginning. So first of all, especially Amazon is getting more and more sensitive about people selling brands mm-hmm. without authority. So mm-hmm. How do you go about getting approval to be a seller for the sale of a product on Amazon?
Yeah. So you need to get ungated in a lot of categories. For instance, toys, you need to get ungated in. Grocery, you need to get ungated in. Vinyls, you need to get ungated in. And so you need invoices from legitimate distributors to prove that you're selling legitimate product and you're not, you know, you're not scamming people. And so to go about that, you can, I looked for a lot of wholesale places online that sell wholesale, and they might not be very cheap, but whenever you only need a certain amount of items to get ungated, to be able to sell grocery, then you can sell the majority of grocery products or the majority of beauty products. And then, like you said, you mentioned brands. Brands is a whole other thing. There's a lot of brands that I'm not ungated in, and I don't necessarily bother to be ungated in. They've protected their brand enough on Amazon, and it's just not worth the hassle for me. Whereas other brands I know that are very profitable, take Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, those for instance, you can get ungated in those pretty easily with an invoice from any wholesale or distributor. There's a lot of places that will give you invoices. And so you get that invoice, and then you're ungated in Nike, or you're ungated in Adidas, and then you can sell the majority of Adidas and Nike products. And, you know, that's a process that I think can be improved on Amazon. I think it's pretty, gimmicky. You know, there's a lot of people who fake invoices. There's a lot of people who copy other people's invoices and things like that. They don't do a lot of due diligence on those invoices. So that's something that can be improved to help those private labels. I mean, for Nike, Nike doesn't have a huge Amazon. You can sell anything on Amazon. Some people own some online arbitrage. Sellers own Nike listings because Nike hasn't created them or things like that. And so Nike, for instance, you know, doesn't matter. But then you have those private labels, whether it's a beauty product or something, that they really want to protect their brand. And you have people who are scamming these invoices and then selling fake products. But that's not about me. I don't do that. And so I find, you know, a niche that I, like I said, sports nutrition, all those things. So now that I've sold enough in that category, a lot of these other products or brands become auto ungated for me because Amazon trusts me in that area. And so that makes things a lot easier in my niche.
Yeah. So you just mentioned something that's really important. So basically Amazon does not know you as a seller when you first sign up. However, they get to know you based on your performance. And this does not mean only your metrics, your feedback, your seller ratings, or in your case, product rating doesn't apply because you are only reselling, but you have your seller feedback rating. So that's mm-hmm. important. And also your performance rating about, you know, customer emails or anything else like that. However, they are also getting to know you, how you are operating the account in terms of systems and processes. Is it something that you're doing just, you know, off the cuff whenever there's any, or are you using flat files and things like that? So how are you doing it? Are you creating a listing just by clicking around, or are you using templated, you know, feeds and things like that? So they get to know you, because why is this important? If you are clicking around, anybody can be clicking around and putting in anything. But if you are using systems automatically, templates and feeds, they come with built-in checks and balances. You cannot really fake things. So that means that the person, to a certain extent, has a good, or the seller has a good understanding of systems. They have somewhat of an infrastructure and things like that. So those people are going to think twice about, you know, submitting a fake invoice, mm-hmm. because they made an investment into an infrastructure, blah, blah, things like that. So that's why it's important. So that's the reason why they automatically ungated you for things that would otherwise be, you know, closed.
Yeah.
I can understand. But I also want to emphasize one other thing that you mentioned. It's easy kind of to gloss over it, so to speak. There are categories that are what Amazon calls gated, which means that you need to get approval in order to sell in those categories. But if you get accepted and you are approved to sell in those categories, doesn't mean that you can sell anything, right?
Right.
You also, you may need approval down to the listing level. You know, you may need approval for the brand. Then for that brand, you may need approval for listing, because some private label companies, whenever they come on the show, I tell them that you remove all the selling rights for all products and grant rights selectively to the sellers that you prefer. You know.
Yeah.
So you know, it's possible to get down to the listing level. So anybody who's looking to do what you are doing, it's a legitimate business. You'll start making money right from the get-go, but you really need to make sure that you are approved to make the sale, because you make the sale today, tomorrow, and then the day after, your seller account is suspended, you're thrown out, and God forbid you get the email, you will never be allowed again. Then that means never, right? Never means never.
Yes. I came close to that once, and it was a very scary situation for me. And it was kind of like you're saying, whenever you have your guests on, you tell them to protect themselves. This brand did not. I don't think they really understood the ins and outs of Amazon. And they just shut me out. They shut all my listings out, and I got flagged by Amazon. It was a serious situation, and they weren't willing to work with me. They thought I was selling fake products. I wasn't. Other people on the listing might have. And so, yeah, I think that's important for private labels to protect themselves and protect their brand. And it'll be better for everybody.
Yeah. So, okay. So now you decided which category, which brand you're going to carry and what listings you're going to stock. And then you went out, bought merchandise. So first of all, share with us some metrics. Okay. In order to make money on Amazon, because you're using fulfillment by Amazon, right?
Yeah.
You're an FBA seller. So you pay Amazon their commission plus the fulfillment fees and anything else. So what is a good model? How much should you be spending on the merchandise? For example, $100 selling price. How much should you be buying it for?
It's usually about half. It's usually right about 50%. And it depends on the weight, obviously, and how big it is, you know, storage fees, shipping, all that. But usually about half. If you can get an item for half of what it's selling for on Amazon, then it's profitable at around 20% margin.
Okay. So,
which is where I operate.
So if your target is 50%, you have 15% Amazon, right?
Yeah.
Your commission says you're up to 65. And then your fulfillment, let's say that you picked right, so it's not very heavy, it's not very big. And then let's say, and your price point is one of the popular price points, like maybe $40, between $40 to $75. So that's usually around 15%, right? Your FBA. So now it's another 15%, so you're up to 80%. So you are left with 20% before anything else. So now on top, you have your storage fees, blah, blah. So now, because you're buying inventory, right? At a time. So you lose the buy box. You cut your price. You cut your price 10%. Your margin now shrank to 10%. You give a coupon for 15% off. You're running at a loss, right?
Exactly.
So tell us about what the struggles that come with that and how you deal with it.
So I would say for a first-time online arbitrage seller, you will get in there. You'll find some products. Oh, these are so profitable. You'll buy them. Say they're half off of what Amazon's selling. You get them in. You send them out. As soon as they get to Amazon, you know, the price starts tanking on Amazon. Your margin goes from what it was, maybe 25%. Now it's 20, 15, and you just bought 100 of these. And now you're breaking even, and you still can't sell them. And so that happens to every online arbitrage seller at the beginning. And it happens to me still. But to mitigate that, you look at the history. You know, you look at the history of what it has been selling. What's the lowest point that this buy box has ever been in the last year? And can I still make money here? Or is this a break-even point? I'll usually decide to purchase it if it's a break-even point. I'll be okay with the possibility of breaking even if it really tanked. But right now it's at 20%, and the average maybe say is around 15%. That's a product I would go for. And so I'd say for, whenever you're looking at it, obviously that's always a risk that something unexpected can happen and the price starts tanking, but you have to look at the history and you have to make your decisions based on the history of the listing. And so that means you're looking at how many they sell per month, how many, sellers are sharing the buy box. What's the lowest price? What's the highest price? What's the average price? And you're making those decisions based on that. I can go in more in depth if you'd like.
Well, this suggests that you actually have systems to store all the data and go back and study and update, of course, all the time, right? So share with us some of those moving blocks.
Yeah, I'd love to.
What is the one need?
So Keepa is the most important. You can look at the history of a listing all the way back, the lifetime of the listing. You can see the sales rank, buy box share, how many people are selling on it, different variations of the listing. That's the most important thing. That'll give you the history of the listing. And you really need to have a good understanding of a Keepa and the Keepa chart. And that just comes over time, and you'll make mistakes. You'll learn hard, you know, learn the hard way, but over time you become an expert at learning Keepa charts. That gives you the most information. I use a tool called Rev Seller, and it's a Chrome tool. And it basically shows the price that Amazon is selling at, or not Amazon, I'm sorry, the buy box. It shows you the price of the buy box. And then you can put in your cost, say, to do business. So for mine, it's 95 cents per item to have prepped and sent to Amazon. And so I'll put that in there. And then it gives you, you can input your cost for the product, and then it shows you your margin and your ROI, how many you could potentially sell, things like that. To find products, I use Tactical Arbitrage, which is a pretty popular tool for online arbitrage sellers, basically. You can search any site online for, it'll go through their products and then it'll cross scan them through Amazon. And given your discount metrics or whatever you're using to get discounts, it'll pump out the ones that are profitable potentially. And then going through there and scanning through the ones that are just a spoof or the ones that are just selling for a really high price today and they won't be tomorrow. So those are the three main tools that I use on a daily basis.
So as far as the buy box calculation, because that's constant battle, right? People are coming in. It's always race to the bottom. Everybody's counting each other. How are you able to keep track of your position in the buy box?
So that's one tool I did forget. It's called BQOOL, B-Q-O-O-L, and that's a repricer. And so it's an AI repricer, and it uses the metrics that I put in and the limitations that I put in on each product. Say, here's my low price, here's my high price. And then you can set an AI. It could be AI sales maximizer, AI profit maximizer. And then it'll use that to compete with the other people. And so some days, well, today, for instance, I sold a product for $38.15, and then an hour later, I sold it for $38.50. And it just is, it's just manipulating the price up and down, trying to win that buy box in between my limitations that I give it. So that's a way I don't have to manage that.
Yeah. So this is a very intense subject for me, because when I was an Amazon seller, I was also, and this goes way back. So
how long? When did you start?
Well, when I opened my Amazon seller account, it was 2004.
Wow.
So I experimented about 5 years what to do, mainly because my purpose for opening a seller account was not to be an Amazon seller, but I was looking for a technology solution to build. Because I'm a technology person, and I was looking to, and I already had an e-commerce solution. I had an online store system, subscription-based. Those days, it was, I launched my online store solution in 1997, just so you have an idea. So it goes way back. I've been in e-commerce since the beginning of e-commerce, I tell everybody.
That's awesome.
So, but by 2004, and by the way, having gone over the dot-com bubble, you know, the first bubble burst and everything, then it was kind of, everything was coming back. But online store business was no longer working without having some kind of a focus on a specific kind of problem that your platform was solving. So I thought, okay, Amazon, I mean, those days, Amazon was also fairly new. Third-party sellers were just new. And I thought, well, this is going to be big in the future. I don't know how I knew. I thought, you know, e-commerce is going to be around. Amazon is growing. So let's become a seller and figure out, you know, what kind of problem I can solve. But yeah. I don't know what problems exist. So let's figure out the problems. That's why I became a seller. And as it happens, I was in health and beauty category, which later I realized was one of the most complex ones. So anyway, so 4 or 5 years, I was just looking. So finally, this is how I started in terms of my real business. So in 2008, I hired a company that did, those days, they called it data feed marketing. And these were former Amazonians. Mm-hmm. And they had venture capital and they started the company. And they taught me some of the Amazon algorithms. And and at the time, I thought that Amazon business was like Google, organic search. You could not really drive anything. There was not a direct driver that you could influence your sales with. So they said, no. He said, it's all about the ASIN. If you pick the right, because there are duplicate entries, if you pick the right ASIN, within a few hours, you could drive sales. So long story short, the next thing I do is I built algorithms and I tested for 5 months by using macro-based Excel sheets to spit out my new price feed. And that price feed would go change the price, and then I would immediately see the surge in orders.
Yeah,
I mean, it was a bliss. But the point is, I was doing it 5 times a day, and I did it for 5 months just to see the trends. And I thought, wow, that's it. I'm going to automate the hell out of this now. So the next thing is we automated the whole thing. So 24/7, my repricer was running. Those days, there was no repricer. Nobody knew what repricer was. They didn't exist. So this is, we're talking about 2009. And that takes me from 50, 60 orders a day to 2,000 orders a day.
Wow.
So I know the power of it. However, here is the thing. And it still lacks to this day because it's a very hard thing to know. All these repricers say enter your minimum and your maximum. Well, I got news for you. Minimums and maximums change all the time because what is a minimum and why would it be minimum? And the minimum for the same SKU can change all the time because you may have too much inventory and the price may be going down. You may have too much inventory and price may be going up. Then your minimum is going to be different for each scenario. Those are the, I had like maybe, I had four fundamental scenarios and each scenario branched out to about five different scenarios and I automated all of those scenarios. So my minimums and maximums were being calculated on the fly and being pushed out in the new price assignment.
That'd be so nice.
I still have my algorithms today, to this day. And I tell you what, I have not seen anything like it.
No, there's nothing like that.
No, it's very hard. And we even had a name for it. It was called Gipper, G-Y-P-R. And the reason why we called Gipper was, we called it Gipper, not Gipper. green, yellow, purple, red. Green is good SKU, makes the profit I want to make. Yellow does not make the profit. It will still turn profit, but I have to lower the minimum because I have too much inventory. Purple is arbitrary. I'm testing. I don't care about the profit. Red is I'm stuck. This one is going to lose big bucks. So, of course, all I did was one setting. And just the green setting, yellow setting, purple setting.
I like that. Yeah, it's easy.
Yeah.
So, I like that a lot. I mean, even Be Cool that I use, it's you know, this AI repricer. And I still have to go in there daily and change. Well, this is not being sold very fast. So I need to lower my minimum.
So I have algorithms that actually spit out. So what I have is when I work with my clients who want to, because sometimes there are situations, even private label sellers have to compete on the buy box because they have legitimate resellers. So, so therefore, you know, they need to be able to establish the minimums and the maximums. So what I have is I have a system that basically spits out the minimums and maximums. In fact, Be Cool is the one that I always recommend. So I have the feed for Be Cool to import. So you have one like a dashboard where you put your settings in. And then based on that, it spits out the minimum and maximum.
That's cool.
You have, because of course, it's the maximums. Maximums are also important because you may be the only seller and you establish the maximum, but it doesn't sell. You may need to drop the maximum. It doesn't mean that you don't have any competition that you can sell at that. No, the goal is to make a sale. So drop the maximum. The system tells you, you know, it's time to drop because we're not picking up any orders. So
all those issues. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your overall, what are the things that you watch out for in terms of running an operation like this?
Like on a like product specific.
Well, level? Anything. Well, the first thing to watch out for is Amazon. What are things that Amazon would really, because, you know, Amazon turns on you, then you're done. You're out of business. Yeah. So that's the most important to me. So what are some things that you need to watch out?
I'd say the biggest one is IP complaints, infringement on people think you're selling fake product or brands kicking you off their listing for whatever it may be. I'd say that's probably the biggest one that will get you shut down the quickest. And that's one that I'm worried about daily. And every product decision I buy is, am I going to get shut down because of this? And so you have to do a lot of due diligence on the brand and the listing. You need to see, have there been a huge drop in seller count over the history of this product? If so, then the brand probably kicked them all off one day and they're likely to do it again. And so you're avoiding that. You're also avoiding selling on listings that the brand is selling on. Usually, I'd say 90% of my SKUs, I'm not competing with the brand. The brand is usually just not even on the listing or worried about it. And so I'm just competing with other arbitrage sellers. That's ideal. That's an ideal listing. On the ones that I do sell with the brand, I use a tool called IP Alert. And so IP Alert, pay a monthly subscription, and they just pull in all the data of IP complaints from the community. I think it's the largest community. So it usually has a pretty good gauge on, hey, this brand is known for doing this. You know, watch out. Don't sell on this brand. And so that's where the biggest watch out is for me right now and will continue to be, because that'll get you shut down the quickest. There's other things like inventory rate. Obviously, you don't want to send in damaged items. You want to make sure you're sending in the right items, the exact items. You know, I've had issues where vitamins, they'll change their branding or they'll change the way the package looks. And so on Amazon, it still looks like the old way, but the ones you're sending in are the new package. And, you know, you get a lot of returns for that. And so you have to watch out for that. And you have to gauge that in your purchasing decision. Well, do I want to buy a lot of these and have 10% returns? Or do I just want to buy a few and manage the few returns? Those are probably the biggest things as an ongoing operation. At the beginning, you're learning a lot of how Amazon Seller Central works and how the heck do I send in products? How do I do that the right way? How do I label these things? Oh, this one needs bubble wrap. What does that mean? What does it mean that this needs a suffocation warning on it? How do I print those out? How do I do that properly so I don't get kicked off or get this inventory sent back? And so that's just a ton of learning on YouTube, reading through Amazon guidelines and just making sure you follow those. And it sucks too whenever the majority of sellers aren't following them and they're getting by with it, but you're the one paying the extra 10 cents, 20 cents for the bubble wrap or whatever. And it doesn't really matter, but whenever it does, you're going to be protected. So you just have to do things the right way the first time.
So do you create ASINs for example, you may create packs. Do you do those things?
I have not done those things. I've looked into it and other online arbitrage sellers do those, but I do not. I have only backpacked off existing listings and existing ASINs.
And what do you think about those? Because that's also another way to do it, right? So you can take two of the same item and then create a value pack. And you just need to issue your own UPC, which you would need to register. But then you will be the only seller on it. Mm-hmm. And it will go under a parent ASIN, right?
Yeah. I think it's genius. I think that's where a lot of online arbitrage sellers operate. I have a certain amount of capital I'm able to spend each month. And so that's kind of one of the metrics I run my business on is just how much am I spending? And so I've fortunately been able to find enough products that is not needed yet and to fill up that capital. You know, if I had twice the amount, maybe I would look for those opportunities. But right now, I'm kind of capped out at backpacking on other ASINs. But yeah.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about managing the financial aspect of this in terms of your metrics and what are the numbers that you're looking at? Because usually if it's a private label seller, I tell them there are two magic bullets. One is your click-through rate. The other is your conversion rate. In your case, I guess the most important one is your buy box retention rate, right? So where are you? So are you tracking your buy box? I mean, your pricing is automated. So I guess they report somehow, but are you keeping an eye on it as a metric?
Not yet. That is not necessarily a metric that I watch daily. For the most part, when I'm making my purchase decisions, I understand, okay, well, there's six sellers on it. So I expect to get, 18%, six divided by 10, 18% of the buy box. And this sells 100 times a month. So I can expect to sell 18 a month, if that makes sense. And so if I'm selling 18 a month, then I'm happy with that. I'm not trying to, sell more unless I have more. For the most part, I make my buying decisions off of how many I expect to sell instead of buying a lot and trying to sell more, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I was doing it, I was tracking two metrics. One was availability. In other words, mm-hmm. out of, 30 days in a month, 30 times 24, so many mm-hmm. hours in a day. So during the course of a month, how many hours and minutes my item was available? And then mm-hmm. what was my buy box retention rate during the time it was available? So then gotcha. You then roll back with the assumption that if I had this available 100% of the time and I had the buy box 100% of the time, that would give me the market size. And from mm-hmm. that market size, now if you know what the market size is, then you can decide, okay, I'm going to try and capture X percent of it. Because mm-hmm. now you know there are no unknowns. You've eliminated all the unknowns. But from that, you can say, okay, this is my target. Therefore, I'm going to buy so many. And then you apply that across X number of SKUs. That's where your income is, right? That's mm-hmm. how much you can generate. And then you can flip that and say, okay, in order to generate this, how much inventory do I need to buy? And mm-hmm. And how does that value of that inventory compare to the net profit I'm going to generate? And that's yeah. usually a very tough relationship because your net profit, you would need like several months of it just to finance mm-hmm. the inventory you carry. And that's why
yeah.
you are in the situation where you're making money, but there is never enough money in the bank account.
Exactly. So I'll give some insight into that. That's obviously a problem that at least online arbitrage sellers deal with. I'm sure private label sellers deal with. I read a book called Profit First, and that book has really put in perspective how to easily operate your finances. And I suggest if you're a small business, maybe reading it. Have you read it, Nick?
No, I don't know that.
Okay. It's basically you set up five bank accounts. One gets all your revenue, and then from your revenue, you divvy out them into a tax account, a profit account, an owner's pay account, and an operating expense account. And you just do percentages. Just keep it easy, percentages. So 10% to operating, or 10% to owner's pay, 5% to profit, 5% to tax, and then the rest go into operating expenses. And so every time you get a check, you divvy it out and you pay yourself from your owner's pay. You keep the profit in the profit. You keep tax for tax. And then the rest of it, you operate on your operating expenses. And at first I'm like, well, percentage, if your income's really high, if your income's really low 1 month, like it's going to go all over the place. And that just doesn't make sense to do percentages. And his philosophy of this book is that as an entrepreneur, no matter how much money you're given in your operating expense, you're going to make it work that month. That's kind of the nitty grittiness of being an entrepreneur. Is at the beginning, you might only have $1,000, but you make it work. And so he's like, if you're not making your operating expenses work, either adjust your percentages elsewhere. But if your business isn't profiting and you're not paying yourself, then maybe you shouldn't be running that business long-term. It should be paying you. It should be rewarding. It's a lot of hard work. It should be rewarding. And obviously there's moments at the beginning where you aren't paying yourself, but eventually you need to be paying yourself. And I think that as an entrepreneur, I've been almost a slave to the business of, well, I'm just not paying myself yet. You know, it'll come. I just got to grow the business. But if I can pay myself 10% and operate the exact same thing with the rest, then I'm going to do that. And so that's what I've been doing. And it's actually works great. I've been a little more nitty gritty with how I spend my money. I don't have a finance team. I don't have anybody like that. And so I just have to be more mindful of where my money is going and that I'm making sure to operate on the rest of that's an operating expense. So that's just, I guess, behind the scenes of the finance. What you were mentioning about the profit and the listing profit and whenever you make buying decisions, my metric is just monthly budget on inventory, I guess. And so let's say hypothetically, I have $1,000 a month to spend on inventory, which isn't very much. But let's say that's what it was, $1,000 a month to spend on inventory. My buying metrics would be, my buying limitations would be, I'm only going to buy products that are 30% ROI, 25% margin. Let's say that. Then I can expect to make $1,300 because my ROI and profit $250. And so as long as I spend that $1,000 under those limitations. And so that's how I operate my business right now, is I just have to make sure I hit the buying limit for each month. And sometimes it's all different products, right? It's never a consistent product. There's occasionally those replenishable products that I have, but the majority of each month, each product is changing. Is this month I'm buying shoes, the next month I'm like, back to school is coming up. And so I'm thinking about buying a lot of backpacks and shoes and clothes, because those things are going to be going out of stock and the price is going to be up, And so I know that because I looked at the history from last year. I know that this product went out of stock last year. There's a good chance it's going out of stock this year. And even if it doesn't, it's still 10% margin. But if it does go out of stock, 40% margin, right? And so then I'm spending that money, that X amount of money, to expect X amount in return based on my buying decisions, if that makes sense.
So you're right. You have to watch inventory, the inventory very closely. And this is where things get complicated, because that calls for inventory accounting. In other words, when you make purchases, on the books, you have to post that. First of all, working as a cash basis business on the books is a no-no. You can't work that way.
Exactly.
So you have to go on accrual basis. And then when you work on accrual basis, you also have to turn on your inventory management so that when you receive merchandise into stock, it increases your balance sheet, your assets, and then it reflects in your payables. Then when you make the sale, you book the sale in, then it automatically adjusts, it reduces the balance sheet, stock value, and then it increases your cost of goods sold. This calls for individual transactions for the sales. So your settlement report has to be integrated into accounting in a way that you're posting the line items. So that means that when you say, okay, I have $1,000 to spend on your inventory, and you say, okay, but I'm carrying $12,000 worth of inventory already, maybe you should not be spending that $1,000 because you're building up stock. If you don't know the value of the stock you are holding real time at all times, you're going to be flying blind with your finances. Yeah. So that's the part that I always warn people against. You know, make sure your accounting is fully integrated with your operation. Especially about inventory management.
So, yeah. Is there a software that you would suggest for that?
Yes, there is, but this is not a software question. It's a question of knowledge of how to do this because it's bookkeeping. And the most people, believe it or not, I have had one client who hired a bookkeeper Well, they had a bookkeeper. Turned out bookkeeper didn't know anything about bookkeeping. And then they hired another one from an agency that supplies bookkeepers. And then they said, okay, we've got somebody to work with you now. And it became a very frustrating experience. And one day I said to her, I just want to understand, you know, your knowledge level. Can you tell me, and I gave an example of a transaction. And my favorite example or question is always, is depreciation a debit or a credit? You know what she said to me? This is a bookkeeper supplied by an agency that provides accounting personnel. She said, well, you know, in all fairness, she said, I have a confession to make. I never studied accounting. And I don't really understand the difference between debits and credits. I always get confused. I always think increase, decrease. I said, you know, you can increase and decrease both debits and credits. So that's what you are dealing with when it comes to knowledge of bookkeeping. And when you add inventory accounting, that becomes much, much harder. So it's more of a knowledge, but you know, depending on the size of the operation you're running, for small businesses, my favorite is use zero and then use A2X accounting as a combination, which, you know, means that your settlement report will be fetched by A2X accounting and then it will get fed into zero with one click. All match gotcha. Different line accounts, line items. So that's my favorite combination. But anyway, it's one of those things. So
that's funny.
So tell me, by the way, just one more thing. So I love it when people write books, you know, but mm-hmm. they never really practiced what they put in the books. So so this book, I didn't know, but it sounds like somebody like that, because the reason I say that, I mean, I don't know the author, but I know one thing. When you are an entrepreneur, you don't have five accounts. You have one account with one goal. Just go after your vision with whatever it takes. And guess what? You're not paying yourself. You're not putting, and if you have a penny coming into that account, it's staying in that account to keep you afloat with whatever it takes. Right? Yeah. So if there is enough money to distribute all over the place like that, at that point, you've already made it. And you have people that will take care of that. So this is not a realistic kind of situation. I don't want anybody listening to this podcast as an entrepreneur to go out and open five accounts. Forget it, guys. Just stick to whatever you have. Hold on to it and then spend whatever you need to spend out of the money that you get until you make it. Once you make it, get the people to deal with, you know, taxes or otherwise. that's the way I see it. So tell me a little bit about yourself. Where do you live and, you know, and where you grew up?
Yeah. So I grew up in Lamar, Missouri. It's a small town in Missouri. And I went to college at John Brown University, which is a private Christian school in Northwest Arkansas. And I just graduated a couple years ago and I moved to Bentonville, Arkansas, which is where I live now with my wife. And I work at Dayspring Cards. And I work full time, and so I'm a full time job, and I sell on Amazon, so that's a cool combination. It's fun,
why did you always have this kind of an entrepreneurial activity on the side, or is this your first one?
Yeah, so I've always had some sort of side gig going. In like third grade, I actually sold comics. For like a quarter at my school. And so I feel like I've always had that knack for just selling things and having that side business. But right out of high school, I customized a pair of shoes. I saw some people on the internet and they were like painting shoes. And I was like, I think I could do that and make money on it, because they were trying to sell them for quite a bit of money. And so I bought a little paint kit and I customized these shoes and I was wearing them. They weren't very good. They didn't look that great, but they were all right. And so I was wearing them around town, in Lamar when I was in high school, and I was going to the barbershop, and my barber was like, dude, we should start a business, man. We should sell these to people. And, you know, we should do Kansas City Chief ones, and people want their Vans customized, whatever, dude, we should totally do this. And, you know, I was like, you know, insecure high school, you know, nervous kid, like, no, I can't sell these, man. Nobody's going to buy these. Nobody wants to do this. And so he kind of gave me the confidence to do it because he was like, I'll help you. I'll go in with you on this. And so he actually bought a lot of the material and the, he was kind of the financial guy there, and it was a very, very small operation, but I didn't have $500 to take this risk really, because I didn't really believe in it. I was just kind of like, I don't know, but he believed in it. So we started a Facebook page, everything, started selling them, and it kind of, I don't want to say it took off, but it definitely kept me busy, and it was a good side business. And I took that into college, and I was losing passion for it. I was losing passion for just like the art aspect of it. And I started outsourcing it to an artist at the school, and I would pay her a certain amount to do the work, and then I would sell the shoes. And so, but I still just didn't really like these small personable transactions that I would have to really chase for a small amount of money. And if I was really passionate about painting, if I was really passionate about shoes, I think that that would work. But just where I was at the time, it just didn't work. But I wanted to know more. I wanted to be more into the shoe space, because I actually really did like shoes, or like designing things and building things, but it just wasn't the specific thing. And so I took a shoe class in New York. I traveled to New York, and I took this 5-day shoe class where I learned how to make a shoe from scratch, like real leather, cut out the leather, you sew it together. And this was a big leap of faith. It took like all the money in my account, even though I was in school. I just want to do something other than school right now. So I went out, and I was just fired up. It was, you know, you're in New York, you're taking this class with other people who are dedicated. They're, you know, a lot of them are entrepreneurs of some kind. And I was like, I'm going to make shoes. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to actually make the shoe for people. This is awesome. And so, and that's like big money in that, because a shoe could be $1,000, $2,000 when it's bespoke, when it's made just for you. So I took it back to Arkansas, and then I realized I'm not an expert at this. It will take forever to be an expert at this. Nobody's going to pay me $1,000 to do something that's not very good, because I'm not an expert. And there's really no market for that here. So I was just kind of left with all this in my hands. Like, well, what do I do with this? I don't want to just, you know, graduate school and get a job and just do that whole gig. I want to have something else. I want to build a business. And so I actually started I took that that sewing skill that I learned in the school, because I'd never sewn before, and I learned how to sew there. And I started making watch bands and wallets and just leather accessories that were out of Louis Vuitton and Gucci bags. So I would take a Louis Vuitton or Gucci bag, and I'd cut it up, and I'd repurpose it into these accessories for people. And I started selling that on Etsy, and that like really took off. And that was just like a little crappy photo on my phone on Etsy. And so it really started taking off. And like a month in, I got professional photos done, and I was still in college, and I was selling $10,000 a week. I think that's where it capped out, at $10,000 a week. And I was just cranking these brands out and everything in my dorm room. I hired a buddy of mine who also went to school to help me out and make these. And I paid him a commission for every one he made. And then, similar to Amazon, Etsy has a lot of rules that I didn't read, and they come in and shut me down because I'm using Louis Vuitton, I'm using Gucci as, you know, the selling point, and I don't have access to do it. I don't have the rights to do that. And so I'm stuck. I'm stuck with all this inventory. I'm stuck with all these designer bags and no way to sell them on Etsy. And so I'm like, well, this is still what I want to do. You know, I was making so much money, I still have to do this. And I realized I wasn't that passionate about it. I was trying to start my own website, and I just kind of lost drive with that. And, tried to start my own brand on Instagram selling these. And I just realized, like, this isn't fun for me anymore. And so that kind of settled down right at the start of COVID. And I started selling things on eBay on COVID. I just wanted to, I always had that knack. So I just started selling and flipping things on eBay. So I did that really hard for 2020. And towards the end of 2020, I took it to Amazon and started retail arbitrage, just buying stuff in store and selling it on Amazon. And then from there, I learned online arbitrage. And so I know that was long-winded, but that was just kind of like from high school into today of just figuring out what my side thing is. What am I passionate about?
Why do you think you're always looking for a side thing?
That's a good question.
Is it money or is it the adventure, the unknown, the risk, something to prove yourself for to yourself or someone else?
I don't know. I want to say it's all the above. I think I like the risk. I like the money. I like proving to myself that I can do something new. I like proving to others that I can do something new. And I really like, I think ultimately it's about building something. I like building something. And that is the business that I'm running now. And I want to keep building it. And I'm really interested in doing private label. I've been doing a lot of research about that lately. And that will be the ultimate build. You're building a brand, you're building a listing, you're building a product. Absolutely.
So I want you to stop giving states evidence, and I want you to start talking about your experience building your own brand. That's what I'd like to see. I think you said it. The reason I think, because I know entrepreneurs, and part of the reason why I started this podcast is to share the entrepreneurial struggle stories. So unfortunately, online arbitrage, especially on Amazon, people don't like it, but that is the real struggle that people go through. It's much, much less struggle in building your own brand. However, it's more capital intensive, but nevertheless, anybody who likes to build things, which is what entrepreneurs do, really, you have to be building your own brand. So that would be the conclusion here that I would say, you know, you've proven yourself to basically adapt to any situation and face any challenge to make it through and figure out the right thing to do. If you are into building stuff, your next challenge, I would say, is building your private label.
I hope so. Maybe next time we talk or next time you have me on, I'll be talking about that, right?
I am counting on that. I think that's your natural progression. I'm thinking I think that you are going to build your private label and you're going to do it very well. And then what I don't need, I can see that happening. What I can't see is what you're going to do after that. I guess we'll see that. So this was great, Kip. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Nick. I love your insight too. Yeah, I love your insight in the Amazon realm, and just giving the advice you've given me has been great. And just listening to the podcast has been great. So it's been fun.
Yeah, thank you. I like talking to people. Listen, entrepreneurs, I always say, they are a totally different breed. And it takes an entrepreneur to understand another one. And our struggles are our struggles. So, you know, whatever I can do, I will.
That's awesome. Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it, Nick. Yeah, thank you.
And that brings us to the end of another episode, and I'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. Be sure and subscribe, rate, and review our show. And be sure and share an episode with a friend. And thank you so much for being with us today. We'll see you next week here on Amazon Legends.